Broadcasting. Arguably, it's been with us since the early Greeks and Romans had their public fora and so on. But for the purposes of today's talk, what I want to actually really focus on is broadcasting with a particularly British perspective and with reference to the British Broadcasting Company and that latterly the British Broadcasting Corporation. So we've got two sets of slides and packages to actually work through. And what I'll effectively be doing is talking through the way in which broadcasting in Britain has developed, but with a few other antecedents as well. Certainly, in terms of developing the medium of radio, America was very much ahead of the game, so were various other European nations in terms of developing radio as a form in which information could be transmitted and developed. And it's interesting that one of the rationales of the British government of the 1920s, apart from being pressurised by the press barons at the time, they were very much focused on what was the appropriate way to develop a broadcasting system, a new technology, a technology which, a bit like plumbing, we didn't quite know where it was going to actually sort of work through or develop and go through, but again, how was it going to relate to the state? There are broadly three types of broadcasting models that you're going to get in the world today and indeed for the last century. One of them is commercial, i.e. purely commercial broadcasting, in which audiences are quite simply delivered to advertisers on the basis of product that's being produced and so on. Then we actually have state-controlled broadcasts or broadcasters in which the government effectively run the broadcasting that's developed. Certainly in the era of the Soviet Union, Pravda, the Truth, was very much a centrally state-operated system. And then you have the public service broadcasters. The public service being very much an aspect of what the BBC was involved. And if we return to approximately 90 years or so ago, a little over 90 years ago, one of the key points about broadcasting was how journalism developed within those broadcasting mechanisms. What were the techniques of radio journalism that developed? Did news on radio require a completely different skill set from actually writing down the news? Again, newspapers at this time were very much in their heyday, highly popular, very influential, very important mass media deliverers. And influential in the same way as Beaverbrook and other press barons would actually be a bit concerned about this upstart radio in terms of what radio was supposed to be providing and so on. As a result, there were certain particular constraints that were placed upon radio journalism, and we look at how the relationship between the BBC and the state also developed and evolved. Some might say it's an aspect of realpolitik. It's the way in which the first Director General of the BBC, John Reith, that swordsman parting the clouds of ignorance, as he saw himself, was somebody who effectively had a particular vision. Other people would say he was simply a bully. And again, we'll look at some of the lines of how the Director General, first Director General of the BBC, actually operated and so on. But let's start off with that opening side of things. Some of the backgrounds in terms of how we got from the start of the 20th century, this radio receiver set where you could actually transmit information and develop information across the airwaves, to his days that David Sarnoff actually was saying in the United States, founders of NBC, something which was marketable, which actually could provide for entertainment, which could actually contain music, it could contain material which people would actually buy and purchase. 2 weeks ago we were looking at newsreels, we were looking at the popularity of cinema, we were looking at how those were developing. This is a domestic example of a killer application in many ways, a way in which suddenly people were very much interested in terms of radio. Let's look at some of the figures and statistics from Wireless World onwards in terms of what no respectful or respecting middle or indeed lower middle class or indeed working class family would be without the wireless receiver set. Between 1922, which is when the British Broadcasting Company was formed, and 1939, the number of radio licences went from a total of 36,000 in 1922 to 8.9 million in 1939. So a significant jump in terms of people actually buying radio receivers and obviously having to have a license to actually listen to the radio across that basis. The ownership of those radio receivers was densest in London and the South East and the Midlands. It was lowest in predominantly rural areas, especially remote districts like the north of Scotland. And ownership, as I've said, percolated through the social system right the way and through until the 1940s, when roughly about a third of working class households didn't have a radio, but two-thirds did. The historian Ross McKibben actually noted that families differed in the way that they listened. There was a tendency in working class households to turn the radio set on and leave it on. Middle class households, on the other hand, were far more discerning in what they actually chose to listen to. The set was turned on for a particular programme, hence the importance of the Radio Times or the listening magazine, and then it would be switched off at the end of the programme. And the BBC colluded in terms of that by actually having silence lasting upwards of 3 to 4 minutes between programmes, just to actually give people a chance to reflect. None of this continuous stream broadcasting. There was a notion of actually having a discerning approach to wireless listening. It was certainly encouraged by the BBC. Now, why was that the case? Why was it that we were having that model of very refined, careful, one particular sports broadcast, pause, followed by perhaps a music programme, pause, followed by another sort of sequence? Why did that occur in Britain, whereas in the United States, and indeed in Europe, with respect to Radio Luxembourg, silence was actually seen as a problem? It's dead air, you needed to fill it, you need to constantly be working through that. Well, partly that was all down to how the BBC was funded. From the onset, the BBC were basically seen as providing a service, but also not one which echoed what, in Parliament's words at the time, was the chaos of the airwaves which occurred in America. The BBC had a monopoly of broadcasting. It only had a challenge, really, from the commercial broadcaster Radio Luxembourg, which started broadcasting in 1933. That was actually known as the Lux, and it actually did carry commercial signals as well from that point of view. But partly in response to the emergence of radio and the calls to appeal to middle brow tastes, the BBC also looked at developing a number of variety programmes which combined comedy, music and human interest stories. Perhaps two of the most successful programmes, which you can access in the 21st century through YouTube or various other things, were Bandwagon and It's That Man Again, or ITMAR as it was referred to. Now, in addition to that variety programming, the whole essence of the BBC was very much this notion of providing content across the airwaves. It was a phrase of Reith's that has gone down very much in history as being vitally important, that it was to inform, to educate and to entertain, that Reith effectively developed his notion of the BBC. Fantastic. Great. Nation shall speak peace unto nation. What's arguable about those very high ideals? Well, to return to this particular timeline, BBC was set up as the British Broadcasting Company, and that's an important line, in 1922. It was set up with the encouragement of the Post Office. And it was also set up by a group of radio manufacturers. So once again, you have this technological determinist approach, as Brian Winston would say, in terms of how people are actually encouraged to buy the technology, to receive the programmes, to effectively sort of be entertained. The notion of what I've described as the chaos of the ether in America was deemed by parliaments that actually that was not suitable for Britain, so that they would only issue one licence to broadcast at any one time. And so the British Broadcasting Company received its first licence to broadcast in 1922. The working capital that it actually had to broadcast, ironically, was exactly the same as the working capital that Siren FM from this university had 10 years ago, £60,000. Okay, different rates. We haven't quite progressed the BBC, but it's early days yet. The revenues actually came from the licence fee, which was 10 shillings. People purchased those licence fees from the post office. And again, half went to the BBC, half went to the post office. And the BBC also received a percentage of the sale of radios by the manufacturers. So, what does this actually mean? You've got two sources of income. One, the licence fee. One, the notion of getting a percentage of the number of radio sets that are being sold. So you've got to drive that mechanism. You don't have any other commercials. So you're also heavily dependent upon the state, both for the receipt of funds through the post office and the granting of a licence to broadcast. This is not a state broadcaster. Parliament are not owning the BBC, but they are effectively controlling the BBC, because if they don't issue the licence to broadcast, effectively, you're out of business. In 1924, the BBC's licence to broadcast was extended by 2 years, and the Sykes Commission was effectively at the heart of recommending that although the state should regulate broadcasting, it shouldn't in itself operate the broadcasting system. Very critical and important aspect in terms of the development of broadcasting, certainly within Britain. Finally, in 1925, the Crawford Committee was set up to examine the future of broadcasting. It actually rejected once again the American system of free and uncontrolled broadcasting for profit, and it also rejected a service which would have been directly controlled by the state. Instead, it came up with this idea of broadcasting in Britain being controlled by a public corporation, which, again, critical phrase here, would act as a trustee for the nation. And because by that stage, the British Broadcasting Company had already been in existence for 3 years, it was thought that rather than actually sort of award it to another company, let's stick with the BBC, it should actually effectively take up the challenge. That whole notion of a public corporation, again, was critical in the development of the BBC and its structure. The company actually became a corporation in January 1927, and John Reith became its first official director general. But you can see in betwixt those times there, in 1926, there was the general strike. Now, I mentioned earlier that one of the things that was very much at odds with the BBC's notion of fair and equivalent broadcasting was that a lot of newspaper owners were quite concerned with this upstart radio. Unlike newsreels, they didn't have ownership of the kind of material that was being broadcast. So what they were interested in was actually developing some way of controlling what was going out. Because if radio was broadcasting news on a regular basis, why would people buy their newspapers? Indeed, that whole notion of a general agreement led to the fact that the BBC were limited in terms of when it could actually broadcast news bulletins lasting no more than 3 minutes and not before 7 p.m. on an evening. So again, they're limited from that sort of point of view. And yet, during the general strike, when the newspapers were actually on strike, surely that was an ideal opportunity for the BBC to really turn around and say, actually, let's really actually do something on this basis. Let's seize this opportunity to extend our news coverage at a time when the vast majority of privately owned newspaper presses were actually out of action. And yet they didn't do it. Why not? Well, the general strike occurred at a very sensitive moment in the BBC's history. Final discussions were underway between this recommendation that the BBC should take up the challenge and actually becoming the British Broadcasting Corporation. The BBC actually then felt, under Reith, that they would use the general strike as an opportunity to demonstrate its responsibility in a crisis. In other words, as Reith had said, because the government had been elected by the people and clearly were representative of the people, then actually reporting against the government's wishes and actually doing anti or pro-general strike issues were going to create problems. Now, clearly, critics at the time saw the BBC's role very differently. They actually saw it accused it of inaction during the strike and actually acting even worse as the mouthpiece of the government. There's John Reith, taking of, again, a line which says, look, it's best to take the government side. Let's work our way through this. Some critics actually refer to the BBC, not as the BBC, but the BFC, the British Falsehood Company, one of whom was the Labour MP for Middlesbrough, Ellen Wilkinson. She actually wrote in a letter to the Radio Times, which was printed in 1926, the following. The attitude of the BBC during the strike caused pain and indignation to many observers. I travelled by car over 2,000 miles during the strike and addressed very many meetings. Everywhere the complaints were bitter that a national broadcasting service subscribed to by every class should have taken quite clearly the side of the government. Personally, I felt like asking for my licence fee back. So even in those early days, you have issues in terms of fairness, impartiality and so on. And throughout the strike, government ministers were given direct access to BBC microphones, whilst the voices of trade unionists and opponents of the government were conspicuously silent. During the strike, however, the BBC did actually increase its number of news broadcasts. They broadcast up to 5 news bulletins a day. And again, they were broadcasting very much in tones that were broadly supportive of the Conservative government of the time. Again, returning to this line by John Reith, he wrote to Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister, and said, the BBC could be trusted to support the government against the trade union movements. In Reith's own words, assuming the BBC is for the people and that the government is for the people, it follows that the BBC must be for the government in times of crisis too. Now, arguably, that process of appeasement actually did work. Although, again, as with all things, there are two sides to the story. In 1927, the BBC could actually schedule their news half an hour earlier at 6:30 p.m. as opposed to 7 p.m. So result, as far as Reith is concerned. And arguably the low point of BBC news broadcasting was actually recorded on Good Friday 1930, in which the organisation, being wary of broadcasting any controversial news stories and any sensational reports or gossip or crime or human incidents, simply announced to its audience that there is no news tonight. End of bulletin. So how does this also relate to John Reith, this whole person of a swordsman putting parting the clouds of ignorance, etc.? Well, according to John Reith, radio broadcasting was to be this sword which parts the clouds of ignorance. And according to his principles, broadcasters had a responsibility to bring the best from every department of human experience, entertainment, achievement and broadcasting, right the way through to the nation. In other words, they were designed to lead human culture. They weren't going to be responding to what people wanted, they were going to be providing what they felt people needed. So you have this notion of high culture, chamber music, areas and issues where you can actually feel as though somehow one's being culturally uplifted. None of this nonsense and trash broadcasting that you actually get. Clearly you're working on this whole premise of how broadcasting should actually work. It should bring all classes together. It should reinforce a sense of national identity. You get the first clear examples of how the BBC is emphasising Britishness, it's developing the whole notion of what it is to be British, and it's providing an image of Britishness as well. Now, with Reith's strong views, it's difficult not to agree with the historians Curran and Seaton, who actually wrote, the British Broadcasting Company was set up as a business, Reith turned it into a crusade. As the historian A.J.P. Taylor noted, Reith used the brute force of monopoly to stamp Christian morality on the British people. So he's very much focusing on what he was looking to develop and so on. And let's look a little bit more at the background. We looked at the background of Grierson and Flaherty a couple of weeks ago. Let's look at John Reith's background. Well, he became managing director of the BBC in 1922 when he was 33. He actually knew very little about broadcasting, but he did know quite a lot about management. Reith himself was a Scottish engineer who had received a strict Calvinist education. And following the war, in which he'd actually been shot in the face by a German sniper, Reith had managed several engineering firms. He was understandably a formidable figure. He was made more so by his stature. He was about 6'5" tall. Churchill actually named him Wuthering Heights, and senior staff would actually stand on stairs to argue with him so that they could actually see him eye to eye. These are, again, factual accounts from the time. Again, according to Curran and Seaton's rather ungenerous description, Reith was pompous, humourless, arrogant, and the most megalomaniacal, paranoid, and self-pitying. So not too many sort of positives coming out of that. Paranoid and self-pitying. His management style was generally seen as interventionist and centralising. And as a result, from early in his regime, he sought to move away from a BBC which was characterised by a largely local coverage. In fact, actually, we have evidence of the first local broadcasting taking place in the early 1920s. 19 stations were established. He centralised into London. Certainly by 1930, local radio had vanished, and it had been centralised into a national programme base that was centred in London, with regional programmes produced from 5 centres which served the Midlands, the North, the South, the South West and Scotland. Northern Ireland and Wales were both added later. This national programme was again in every sense the senior player, with the regions very much seen as juniors. So again, if you weren't liked within the centralised BBC office, if you wanted to work within the BBC, you needed to be based in London. Otherwise, frankly, you wouldn't be rising too far within the corporation. Throughout the 1930s, there were substantial fractions and tensions between the centre, London, and the regions. And Reith actually used that classic management style of divide and conquer as a way of effectively exiling any rebellious staff. As one BBC employee once heard Reith say to another, "You're a very dangerous man, Harding," says Gilbert Harding. "I think you better go up north where you don't do so much damage." According to one former BBC employee, R.S. Lambert, who was editor of the BBC magazine The Listener between 1929 and 1939, all personalities at the BBC were dwarfed by that of Reith. He tended to surround himself with yes-men on the control board, and again, they consisted very much of 4 or 5 organisations and bands and representations with which the BBC was organised. It was set up in terms of departments. Again, a concept of divide and rule. It's a little surprise, then, that by the time 1938 came round, we actually had a situation where basically, as Reith went, the last sort of music that was played on BBC was Who's Afraid of the Big, Big Bad Wolf? Now, again, there are two sides to every story. We've heard some of the disaffected few former employees. However, the BBC itself, when you look at the internal memos, saw itself as humane, enlightened, and also to one which had produced and pursued strictly egalitarian and meritocratic appointments. It was also pointed out that they had a large number of women working for the BBC, although it was noted most of those were in secretarial positions. Ultimately, this atmosphere of intimidation, constant change, and insecurity did lead many BBC employees to effectively work through the system whilst at the same time being really heartsick of Reith's reign. And to the relief of many, he left the BBC in 1938 to take up control of British Airways. So let's look again at some of the other issues that relate to this whole notion of the BBC in the 30s. This sort of notion of how it was developing within the whole system. Well, as I've already said, news and journalism was very much a minority part of the BBC. It didn't really evolve in terms of genuine radio journalism techniques until the middle part of the 30s. BBC News formed a very small part of what was referred to as the talks department. It was headed by one of the BBC's most influential female employees, a progressive lady called Hilda Matheson. And according to R.S. Lambert, Hilda Matheson had an enthusiasm for feminism, for socialism, and modernism in the arts and literature. She actually made the talks department between 1927 and 1932 into a place which was lively, which was energetic, and was actually humane in which to work. The talks that she produced focused upon developments in literature and politics, they experimented with education, and they also improved and expanded the news and what would be regarded as news bulletins and areas within that. In 1930, the BBC finally gained the right to edit and use its own news bulletins. Prior to 1930, they just had to have the news bulletins prepared externally for them and submitted, so they basically just read them out, read out what they were given. 1930, they'd finally developed to such maturity they could write their own. And a tiny news section was established which composed the nightly news bulletins. Again, let's look at some of the numbers here. Staff in the news section of the BBC in 1934, six. In 1934, John Coatman, who was a former professor of economics at London University, became chief news editor. And his appointment started to demonstrate the growing importance of news within the BBC. He was also brought in to offer a right-wing counterbalance to what was seen as the somewhat left-wing tendencies of the Talks department, run, of course, by Hilda Matheson. And Hilda Matheson and her successor, Charles Seatman, actually came under increasing pressure during their tenure at the Talks department for what they were being told was redness or pinkness. The Daily Mail, and don't forget we have a Daily Mail, a Mail on Sunday journalist coming in to join us this very evening at the talk at 6:30, the wonderful Peter Hitchens. The Daily Mail back in the 30s regularly attacked the left-wing bias of the Talks department, especially its choice of speakers, who often included people like George Bernard Shaw, Harold Nicholson, Winston Churchill, Lady Astor, John Maynard Keynes, and others. Obviously all far side of left-wing thinking. I think not, but nevertheless, that's perception. As Lambert explained, the BBC was extremely sensitive to these press attacks. Obviously, as we said earlier, the BBC has only two sources of income. One, the government approval that it's all right to actually continue to have a licence fee, and secondly, some radio set income. That's not a great deal to actually base future success on. So inevitably, you're going to be sensitive to attacks of bias and so on. And so the Talks policies and the people who were invited to give talks to the BBC became more and more conservative. And the BBC actually sharpened up its self-censorship processes. So how did it actually do this? What was the process by which the BBC engaged in self-censorship? Well, it pretty much went in two forms: long-term censorship and short-term censorship. Long-term censorship was performed by a network of committees, which one after the other would veto the original programme idea. So if you had an idea to produce something about the philosophy of swan culture in Lincoln, you might submit that to the Talks department and they might say, rubbish, take it away. But the idea would basically be, first of all, discussed with the Talks director, and then it would be perhaps sent on to a Talks departmental meeting. Then they would go to the Talks Advisory Committee, which included a body of outside experts. The plans then had to be approved by the Programme Board, and then finally passed by the Board of Governors. The programme ideas were actually quizzed from every angle. They were quizzed from the angle of politics, from religious aspects, from commercial aspects. The subject itself might have been a good one, but was this the right time to actually broadcast it? Should government officials be consulted? Wouldn't a business interest be offended? And in addition to that long-term censorship of talks, which clearly could have actually given many programme makers reason to give up the will to actually pursue the matter in the first place, there were a series of short-term censorship issues that were brought into place as well. That actually took the form of censoring talk scripts. Before any speaker actually went on air, a copy of the script had to be submitted to the Talks department and the production team. There would be several versions of this. There would be an advanced script. There would then be a revised script. There would then be a rehearsal script. And there would then be a final script, which would be final as broadcast. And anything that the speakers wished to say was negotiated between those four, minimum of four, different areas. A Talks assistant would be appointed to deal with them, and scripts would often be revised in the name of broadcasting technique, which would often remove any potentially controversial statements or demands of the talk. Now, according to Lambert, broadcasting technique also played a considerable part in the censorship of persons apart from their scripts. He actually noted the following. It is remarkable how often those who have criticised the BBC or proved indiscreet or difficult as talkers are discovered to be deficient in some essential of the technique of broadcasting. Their voice might be seen as unpleasant. Their accent might be wrong. Their style might be dull. Their personality doesn't come across. Now, often that might well be true, but often it's a polite way of saying no to a speaker who actually wasn't wanted because of other reasons. Finally, in 1935, the BBC founded a news department. This was separate from the talks department, and it was designed to expand steadily. Certainly by 1938, it had actually risen to a staff of 31, the majority of whom were actually experienced print journalists, which again was quite an interesting line in terms of where the skill set was being recruited from as far as the BBC was concerned. As the news lead, a gentleman called Geoffrey Strutt actually noted in 1927, before 8 years before the talks about the news department was established, the whole aim and object of the news service is to avoid the errors into which journalists, as such, seem inevitably to fall. Errors such as sensationalism, inaccuracy, partiality, and overstatement, and to present news of all that is happening in the world in a clear, impartial, and succinct language. All very laudable claims, you might well feel. All very positive claims and lines that actually fit into place. But again, in terms of time, very frustrating. So how do we get to this stage whereby the BBC begins to find its voice and actually sort of begins to develop its confidence to open up as a broadcaster which can effectively relate not only to the establishment, but actually become the much-loved line of what we understand today as being Auntie Beam. As you can see, Broadcasting House opened in 1932. You may be able to spot John Reith once again there from other things. He's the central chap there, again, with his board of governors, obviously sort of ensuring that everything is well put together and sorted through from this point of view. It's often said that it was the live reporting of the fire at Crystal Palace Exhibition Centre, described by Richard Dimbleby, the father of David Dimbleby, and Jonathan Dimbleby, which really started proving that the news team had what it takes. In America, news bulletins and journalists from Edinburgh onwards had clearly been already taking advantage of being present in various other areas. And this particular image from World War II also is one of those critical aspects in terms of where the BBC develops and so on. I.e. the family, with the sole source of information being BBC Radio. Television had been around. Lots of sort of areas that were being explored within television. In fact, the first television set was installed in Downing Street in 1930. And at the time, the Prime Minister actually said, "How wondrous this set is. It'll enable us to actually maintain links with all the empire," in a wonderful sort of sequence from that point of view. Again, the apocryphal tale is that television actually ceased in 1939 with the onset of war, halfway through the Mickey Mouse cartoon that was being screened at the time, and then resumed in 1946, picking up after a little short interruption in betwixt times. But still, as a way of actually unifying the nation, radio very much vital to this whole notion. There was certainly the notion in society in the Second World War that actually nobody wanted it. It wasn't like the Great War. It wasn't the First War where there was a campaign to go to war. Nobody actually really wanted to fight. Certainly didn't want to have gas masks to hand to actually sort of, you know, deal with disasters and various other bits and pieces. There was also a sense that if nobody actually wants to fight, society's going to collapse. Because how can you force people to fight if they don't want to fight? Are you going to have mass hysteria? How can you develop this whole notion of public morale? Again, the things we talked about with respect to documentarians, filmmakers, and so on. So you see a lot of cross-references in terms of that. Certainly there was a big shift from normal programming, and again, by this stage, we actually established three major lines here: the home service, the light program, and the third program, with a wonderful halcyon image there of the mother and her children sort of gathered around the news and so on. But again, there was a sense that if you actually changed all of the news formats from 1939 and actually lost all the variety programmes, lost all the entertainment programmes, simply stayed very much with a static, sombre tone, morale would plummet. So you needed to develop a whole range of variety that was developed within that. Arguably, the first radio personality was a gentleman called William Joyce, known as Lord Haw-Haw. He was an English aristocrat who had inside knowledge and was a keen Nazi supporter. He was ultimately executed at the end of the war. But again, he would often sort of lead over his own Germany calling and develop a whole range of elements within that field. Again, proving, not the BBC, but proving that there were issues relating to that. And certainly Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, the Blitz, lots of instances here where the notion of how Britain was being represented to the world was constantly being developed. We also had reporters from America commenting on how things were going. I talked a couple of weeks ago about the way in which propaganda was being developed and so on. These are key elements that we're seeing all put to the fore in terms of how this mass medium of broadcasting is developing from Alexander Palace to the world and so on. Incidentally, the reason television was suspended within Britain during the war was because it was deemed that actually the television signals could actually act as a signal locator for German bombing raids. Has that actually proved? I might. Move along through the war years, and there's lots of material which we can play in seminars which actually gives you some of the broadcasters who worked through this scenario, including characters such as Tommy Hanley, It's That Man Again, a whole range of the girl next door of Vera Lynn, Dame Vera Lynn, still functioning today, still around, and a range of other speakers who are brought on board. You're actually seeing a whole growth of the radio personality. Now, that's quite apart from the Churchill speeches and the way in which, again, it's often said that his radio presence actually, again, galvanised a nation in so many ways. But you're seeing the BBC very much becoming embedded as part of the country's fabric, as part of the national fabric, and again, reciprocating that by replicating and reinforcing itself within the technology. The technology itself is still very large, very clunky. It's very much on the basis of, again, reinforcing class stereotypes and images from that perspective. Studios are very hot, areas that are working through that basis, but there is a variety that's there. And remember, the BBC have a monopoly. Commercial television doesn't start until 1955. Commercial radio in Britain doesn't start until 1973. So that intervening period of nigh on 40 years effectively allows the BBC to effectively be the only player in town. It can actually pretty much do what it wants, safe in the knowledge that people will buy their television sets, watch the sequence and so on. Talking about buying television sets, this was a huge push towards television success in terms of really going up there. The coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1953. Clearly one of those key elements in which more and more people started buying television to share, to work through, obviously in black and white. Cinema is still very popular as a media form and so on, but still echoing that notion of, again, the BBC really showing what Britain does best to the world, a darn good royal occasion and scenario. And in keeping with the earlier times within the radio side of things, where people don't want to get too overexcited, and you've got to have a specific time when children will be sent to bed, normally 6 o'clock, you have an interlude. You have lots of interludes. It's very calming. It's like sort of centering on the sort of the inner individual. It's arguably the BBC's early approach of centering in the moment, etc., and conscious thinking, etc. You're also getting the growth of the television personality. Comedians and folk who had effectively developed their trade during the war years, working for the troops, entertaining the troops, Bruce Forsyth, Sid James, a whole range of sort of folk, many of whom are sort of obviously heading off to Heaven FM, if they haven't already gone over there. But the whole notion of variety shows is very much developed and worked through that whole premise. Add to that the growth of commercial television and the coverage that BBC nationally actually providing, and you think, well, everything in the garden is lovely. You can even take radio plays and put them on TV, and it'll work even better. St. James and Tony Hancock, Hancock's Half Hour. So suddenly that dream that Reith actually had of inform, educate and entertain seems to actually be coming to the fore. Even in this particular instance, Quatermass, forerunner to the more famous Doctor Who series, was very much seen as must-catch viewing. And then, of course, controller of BBC Two in the 1960s, Hugh Carlton Green oversees colour and the impact of colour television, not demonstrated by, I've just got a colour slide for this, but also impacts its whole way. The establishment of Television Centre becomes a kind of central point, the concrete donut, although most of this is now gone, it's been replaced by Broadcasting House, but it's still thriving. Because as a medium broadcast form, you've got television and radio working side by side, even with respect to commercialisation and so on. There's the opportunity to develop new comedy shows, Galton and Simpson, The Playhouse, Steptoe and Son, being one of many productions that are there. Only quiz question I'm putting into the lecture today. Does anybody give me two series that this gentleman was responsible for? He's Canadian. Two classic icons of British television. What was he actually responsible for commissioning? One was for a commercial network, one was for BBC. Any ideas? Oh, I could have had a prize as well. Okay, it was The Avengers for ITV. The original Avengers with John Steed and Emma Peel, not the Latter Marvel Cox interpretation. And Doctor Who, as far as BBC is concerned. Although Sidney Newman is actually on record as saying in a memo to Verity Lambert, the one thing he wanted to avoid with Doctor Who, at all costs, were bug-eyed monsters. And of course, the second serial, you get Doctor Who and the Daleks, and so on. And so it continues. So we've actually travelled quite a way, including, as say, dramas such as Catherine Come Home, etc., from those early tentative steps that were provided by the BBC when it was originally established as a British broadcasting company in 1922. As we said, the road was often full of tense moments, moments where the BBC was criticised, Mary Whitehouse here on the right-hand side being the founder of the National Viewers and Listeners Association, who basically sort of was very concerned about the filth that the BBC was broadcasting and the terrible ways in which it was reflecting negative 1960s culture and a permissive society, and how actually it had lost its way, and that Reith was actually right, and it would never have occurred under Reith's years, and so on and so forth. Even to the present day, when Hugh Bonneville, who actually is the lead in W1A, says sometimes he feels a little bit guilty about the way in which the BBC used W1A to kind of criticise itself and lampoon itself, although many of those kind of areas in the satire are seen as very much to the fore. And clearly there's always the competition. In this particular case from commercial television, Coronation Street, established in 1960, still with us today, still kind of echoing its kind of soap opera roots and developments. Where is television going? And I've deliberately focused in this lecture on television and radio. Frankly, as I'm sure many people in the BBC and broadcasters will say, they're not exactly sure with respect to the multimedia, multi-platform delivery that we currently have. But suffice it to say, whereas the 20th century was by far the most visually recorded, the most audio recorded 100 years in human history, I think it's only fair to say that that's going to probably increase even more with the multi-platform social networking media that we actually have in the 21st century. Or maybe we'll all have an electromagnetic pulse and everything will actually end from that point of view. And I close with a slide actually of Zedcars, which again was the first sort of BBC attempt after going away from Dixon of Dock Green to really start dealing with social drama and realism. Make sure you've signed the register, which should have hopefully made its way to the front now, being well, and I'll see you next time.